So this afternoon, I'd like to talk about a bit about working with thoughts and emotions. In a practice this weekend, I just alluded to and tried to review as a way of reminder for some of you, and perhaps as a way of teaching for others who are just beginning the practice, that the first four foundations of mindfulness are mindfulness of breath and body, and mindfulness of vedana, that is, whether you find or your response to your experience is that it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then the third foundation is mindfulness of emotions and mind states. And the last foundation, the fourth, is called mindfulness of mind or contents of mind. And it was first described to me as all the rest of the stuff. So and I think it's meant, basically, it's a foundation of mindfulness is an understanding of the Dharma, the way things are. And we come to that understanding through our own direct experience. And the practice that leads us there is that one of them is the practice of mindfulness. So we begin to learn about the truth of things, that things, everything is impermanent, and that there is suffering and a cause of suffering, and all of those, all of the other stuff. So that's usually included in talks and in discussions and question and answer periods and so on. So I'm going to talk a little bit about working with thoughts and emotions today. Some of you are familiar with the very early days of research on the plasticity of the mind. And Matthieu Ricard, a French monk, was the subject of one of the first big studies that was begun by the, or initiated by the Dalai Lama and other psychologists, neuroscientists, and people, a subject such as Matthieu Ricard, to start to see the initial impulse was to see, to prove that mind training, meditation, had actually an influence on the brain. That was what the Dalai Lama wanted to set out. He wanted to prove to those in Asia who he wanted to prove to those who believed that it was just magic or hocus pocus to meditate and all of these other practices of training the mind. He wanted to prove that, in fact, it was effective and effective in a very profound way. And, of course, Ricard was the initial subject, and his brain was examined by the functional MRI and seemed to have changed as a result of 3 years of compassion practice, that the actual organ of the brain had changed, which has nothing to do with this talk except to identify what he said, which I thought was he had a very clear and succinct way of talking about the importance of and the process of becoming aware of thoughts and as a way of training the mind. He says, the way we deal with thoughts is not to block them, nor to feed them, but to let them arise and dissolve by themselves in the field of mindfulness. And then he goes on to say, meditation consists of cultivating a way of being that is not subject to the pattern of habitual thinking. To cultivate a way of being that is not that is not subject to the patterns of habitual thinking. In other words, habits of mind. And also, he goes on to say that he believes that freedom by mastering the mind is the optimal state of happiness. The freedom of mastering the mind is the optimal state of happiness. Of course, he wrote a very interesting book on happiness, which some of you may have read. Anyway, this is very easy to say, you know, to just to not to block the thoughts, but simply to free them and let them arise and dissolve by themselves. That's easy to say, but most of us find that somehow a bit of a challenge. Not too easy to accomplish it, because thoughts are almost always accompanied by emotions. And that somehow muddies the water. And we really sometimes raise the question, well, don't thoughts come from emotions? And then others will say, well, don't emotions come from thoughts? And in fact, we don't know. And it really doesn't matter. What we want to know is how to deal with that, with the arising of thoughts and emotions at the same times. Now, we know that thoughts by themselves are ephemeral, right? They have no substance at all. There's no color, there's no shape, there's no physical reality. They're just unsubstantial. So where does their power come from? You know, that's the interesting question. And the answer seems to be the power they have is the power we give them. It's not, thoughts have no power in themselves unless we give it to them. It's interesting that when you let them go, that is when you note that you've just been thinking, some of you may have observed what happens. If you just note it, thinking, it's gone. It has no power when we simply recognize that it's there. It has power when we become tangled in the content of the thought. When we begin to verbalize our experience, explain it, attribute certain qualities to it, reasons for it, history of it. When we start verbalizing the experience, that's when we get into trouble. And I think it's been interesting. I've had a few notes. I had a couple today, but I haven't really looked at them. But it is kind of a natural byproduct of talking about thoughts, that there'll be a few people around who grab that and start thinking about it. And it's sort of cruel, in a way, to think that that's what's happened. However, I appreciate the questions. So we notice that when we simply notice the thought is there and then leave it alone, that it pretty quickly disappears, unless, of course, we have some habit of mind that we didn't bring to bear on that thought. Now, one of the interesting things is, so the thought comes up and an emotion comes with it, or at the same time, or maybe it comes first. Again, it doesn't matter. We, because of our conditioning, tend to get very involved and interested in the emotion. We're conditioned to think emotions are pretty special things here in North America. And because of this, we get pretty wound up, especially when the thoughts are, or emotions are strong. We'll have a thought, then this emotion will come up, and then the reaction starts to happen. When you experience fear, or when you experience anger, the thoughts just come flooding in. It's an amazing thing. Those are two very strong emotions. We tend to want to avoid them or get totally involved with them. There's a Zen teaching that's called No Mind, and it goes something like this. A person paints a tiger. This is a teaching. A person paints a tiger, and then the teaching goes, all is mind-made. It's like a person painting a tiger. He paints it, looks at it, and is frightened. All is the brushwork of your imagination. All is mind. All is the brushwork of your own imagination. So the important learning for us is that we must remember to separate the thought from the emotion. If the thought is ephemeral, why would we pay any attention to it? As soon as a strong emotion arises, don't go with the thought. The first thing to do is to go with where the substance is. The substance is in the body. So how do we work with emotion? We move from any thought that has come with it, and we move to the possibility that this emotion is manifesting in the body. Because, in fact, it does. This body of ours is full of emotion. Many of them have been dulled, covered over. We don't feel them anymore. In fact, I think that's one of the remarkable effects of mindfulness practice, is it uncovers all of this hidden life that we hold inside of us. You know, as we're young, when we're young, we're growing up, we have experiences, some of them very painful, or we have ongoing difficulties so that eventually we can't stand to feel the emotion. And so we just stop feeling it. You know, this is all of the Buddhists. The Buddha had great psychology. You know, he says, this is where it's all happening. You've got to look at these senses, because that is all of your direct experience right there. And it's experienced through the body, and it's held there. If it's not expressed, it can be held, it can be hidden, it can be unconscious. And we're acting from those held emotions. We're not aware of it, but that's what we're acting from. I'll just share quickly an experience of my own. If when I was growing up, I don't know, I would have said my whole life, and anyone that knew me up until about 20 years ago would have said no. I would have said no. I don't experience anxiety. I really don't. And others who know me well would say, no, she never seems anxious. And at some points in my life, I was doing some things that I would normally have had anxiety about or worry about, and I just didn't experience it. And one day, as I was driving across town to meet a client, and some of you may have heard this story before, because I usually illustrate this particular point with this story. It's so compelling to me. Driving across town to meet a new client, I was a consultant, and I was just driving, that's all, and it was a long drive, and I noticed that I had a kind of strange feeling here, and looked at my watch, it was past lunchtime, and I thought, you know, I really should have had lunch before I left. So I thought, it's where you experience hunger, at least where I experience hunger. But there was something a little bit off about that feeling, so I, at every stoplight, I would really stop for a few minutes and just get curious about what that was, because it wasn't exactly hunger. And then somewhere along the way, I don't know, 20 minutes into the drive, I just had this image come to me, just flashed in my mind, of myself standing at the back gate of our yard in Calgary after school, and that was exactly the feeling that I had. Every night, coming home from school, standing at the gate and wondering what kind of mood my mother was in. And it was just total and complete anxiety, and I had never experienced it later. I don't know when I stopped experiencing it, sometime probably when I was around 5 or 6 years old. And until that day, I had never experienced it. And I realized I was anxious about going to meet this client. It had just suddenly, the body had just opened up and revealed that to me. So, you know, this is a very complex system we have. I mean, there is a lot in there. And so if we want to unlock some of those little mysteries, and if we want to get in touch with our emotions and find up, find out why sometimes we act so unskillfully when that wasn't our intention. And we realize now, or I realize now, some kinds of behaviors that came from that emotion that I just stopped allowing myself to feel. So it's emotions are there, and they have so much to tell us, and there is so much to open to. So when an emotion arises, the first thing that we do is we say, "Oh, I'm afraid." I'm afraid, or that comes to your mind. Oh, I'm afraid to do that. Then just stop and just give yourself a chance to see if it's manifesting there. If you can touch into it. Now, when you're doing a sitting in your formal practice, that's what you do. A thought will come up, and rather than proliferate a bunch of thoughts around the fear, stop. And allow yourself to drop into the body. Is there a sensation there? Sometimes there will be. It may be very available and accessible. And if there is, then don't even think about it. Just be curious about that sensation. It will tell you much more than any thoughts you could generate. If you say to yourself, "Well, I'm afraid," it's a thought, and you drop into the body and take a little scan and wait and listen, and nothing is there, don't worry about it. It's hidden away somewhere. You don't have to look for it. You don't have to move, or you don't have to try hard, whatever that would be. But just entertain the possibility that it might show itself now, or the next time, or the next time, or the next time. You know, the body has its own schedule. The mind has its own schedule. You know, this organism has its own schedule. So just entertain the possibility, and if it doesn't happen this time, it may happen eventually. The body is the place that you can depend on, not the mind. I mean, not the thought, sorry. The body will show you. The mind will just complicate it all. I was trying to... I was thinking about some examples, and I thought, you know, if I try an example, I can just have an absolute tsunami of thoughts. You know, I could go on just as we would on the cushion for 25 minutes. And I gave an example the other night when I was talking about, you know, the torrent of thoughts when my leg went to sleep on the cushion, you know, and I had myself in the hospital having my leg amputated within 30 seconds. So I think you can all bring your own examples to that particular process. So instead of going to the mind, go to the body. Now, because emotions and thoughts can arrive together, it's important not to cultivate the emotion by bringing on this torrent of thought. If I can use another image, and you may be full of images here, but we see that a lot in the Buddhist literature. So I can add one here in 2011 for what it's worth. But I see these strong emotions like bonfires. They're like fires, and often the physical sensation, say, of anger can be, you know, of heat and fire. Sometimes even fear can feel like a fire, like hot pressure in the belly. You know, they do. Their physical images are quite interesting. But we can see these emotions that are very strong, like real craving, you know, intense craving, and anger and ill will. Those are hot. Those are hot emotions. But all emotions we can imagine, the strong ones, are like fires. And if you want that fire to grow, all you have to do is pour the gasoline of thoughts on it. The more thoughts you generate and add to that fire, the bigger the blaze and the longer it's going to last. And that's no way to explore it. All you're doing is intensifying it. So resist the habit if you can, the habit of mind, whatever you've, and some of you may have already connected with some of the habits of mind that you have that are not too skillful. If you tend to catastrophize, you're pouring lots of gas on your issues. You know, if you like to dig a hole and put yourself in it as a victim, you know, and just pile some more stuff on that, you just build a big bonfire in that hole with all the thoughts that you tell yourself. Now, the mind isn't affected permanently by the smoke of the fire, let me put it that way. But the smoke of the fire actually distorts the way you see things. It's like looking through smoke. It doesn't damage the mind permanently, but while you're in the heat of those strong emotions and you're fanning the fire or feeding the fire, you're not seeing clearly. And the nature of mind, of the natural mind, is to be clear, is to be calm and to be clear. You know, so fanning the fires of these strong emotions, you're just distorting your view. You're changing what you're looking through to see the reality beyond it. It's not permanent, but as long as you're in the thralls of that emotion, it's temporarily dulled. The mind is not seen clearly. Now, you'll notice this if you do intensive practice, and some of you have probably experienced this. When you're on retreat, these are just some examples of how the mind gets distorted. So if you're on retreat and you're have been sitting for quite a while, the mind is in a very I wouldn't say tender, but it's in a very vulnerable place. It's very open, and the emotions are open. But if you're not looking too closely at some of your perceptions, they can become quite distorted. It's good old greed, hatred, and delusion come up again and again, particularly when you're vulnerable to them. Now, this craving, when you're in a state of desire and you're on retreat and the mind is very vulnerable, this is really a common distortion. Just craving. You see something and you see it, you want it, and the view of what you see is so distorted that you don't realize what you're going after. It manifests on retreat quite often as what's called the Vipassana romance. You're sitting in a retreat with, oh, maybe 60 people like this, or 100 people, or 150 people. They wouldn't be like this. A number of you know one another, but you'll be in a retreat of 120 people. You don't know too many people, but you're sitting there, and somebody will catch your eye, and it's instant lust at first sight. You just know as soon as silence is broken, you're going to talk to that person, and you're probably going to get married. And by the time the retreat's over, you've had a couple of kids, and you're living in Florida. I don't know. But the mind just does that. Like it does not see clearly at all. I mean, we're laughing now, but when you're in the thralls of Vipassana romance, that intense craving, that's just exactly what it's like. I know that from a report. It didn't happen to me. I had the next example. This is when ill will visits you and you have a Vipassana vendetta. And this is how that one happened. And I saw that when you're on a big retreat and your meals are provided, you have all kinds of things happening in your mind. Lunch is theater, actually, and you're lined up on the getting your food because, you know, you're there and you've got all these things going through your mind. And I saw this man that I didn't know who he was or whatever, and I just looked at him, and I watched the way he was piling stuff on his plate. And it was, like, immense. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I even had a name for him, and I'm not going to tell you what it was. And every time I saw him, that's all I saw is this guy who was just really like a pig. That wasn't the name I had for him. But anyway. And I had a whole story about him. After 6 weeks, I just knew what he was like. You know, I just had this whole scenario about the way he probably lived and the people who were his friends, and it was just disgusting. And this is all created for, I mean, I never spoke to him. I mean, he didn't even sit near me. I just saw him in the lunch line. So, and this is what happened at the end of the retreat, and this was at Yucca Valley. At the end of the retreat, to break silence, Yucca Valley is just outside of Palm Springs, if you don't know that, and it's near Joshua Tree National Monument. So when we broke silence, everyone went into cars, like cars full of people, went out into the hills in Joshua Tree, and there's a specific walk that's really quite wonderful, and you're just out there in the nature and all these huge rocks and Joshua trees. And so we were just instructed to go out there in the silence of nature and then perhaps one or two to just get together and break your silence very just in a small way, but in this large space, because when you break it in a small space, you give yourself a headache, you know, with everybody's talking and there's a lot of hubbub. So we went out there, and to get out there, I was put in a car with this guy, with my Vipassana Vendetta. And as we got to the park, and we were getting out of the car, he and I started talking to one another, and he was the nicest person. And I really got it, because I had really created this monster in my mind, and I believed it. And it was an astonishing teaching to me. Because, you know, we do it all the time in large and small ways. So that's the power of thought, especially when you fuel it. I mean, I had real, even physical feelings about him when I had that story. Can hardly, he was a very nice man. In fact, he was a therapist. Anyway, so there we are. But my ill will and my imaginings and thoughts and stories around him had just created something that was totally false. It totally clouded any judgment that I had, even that I should have any thoughts about him, because I'd never talked to him before. So that's what craving and ill will can do when you really have the emotions taking charge of you and you believe the thoughts and don't bother looking at anything else. And the third thing that, and both of those things, when you're in both of those situations, it leads to a proliferation of thoughts. When your clear seeing is clouded, it just more and more thoughts come up, and that proliferation just makes your view less and less unclear, or less and less clear. Now, the third force that leads to proliferation is ignorance. It's just not seeing anything at all. That's anywhere near the truth. And one of the most difficult ones is comparing mind. It's ignorance of the truth of anything. For example, comparing mind, well, you know how that goes. You're sitting on, I'll say take a retreat again, or take any time, you're sitting there and everybody can do this but me. That's the first thought that comes. Everyone can do this, I can't. It's always been that way. And then you list all the things that everyone could do that you couldn't do. In fact, that's the way my whole life is. I'm just a loser. And it goes on and on and on. And then you lose all sight of who you are, what you can do, what the reality is out there. There could be everyone can't do it, but you don't know that. So craving, like being caught in craving, being caught in ill will, being caught in comparing mind, those are just three examples that lead to this proliferation of thought. Those could be names of unskillful mind states, right? Unskillful habits of mind. I mean, do you know anyone who looks around and all they see are things that don't work, that don't look good, that aren't appropriate, that aren't acting properly? Do you know people who, well, this is actually, we could talk about personality types. we're down another side trail. You know, in Buddhist psychology, there are three personality types. There's the greedy type, and as it was described to me very quickly, a person walks into a room, and the first thing they see is something they really like, wish they had, and want to know how to get one. And if you're that, so that's basically shorthand greedy type. And all of these, by the way, can be transformed and are. The second is the aversive type. They walk into a room and all they can see is the things that don't match or bad colors and clothes that people shouldn't be wearing and shoes that don't match the whatever. So that's, you can just start classifying yourself right now if you like. And then the third one, of course, is the confused type, the ignorant type, the befuddled type, doesn't know what's. They walk into a room and say, oh, is this a birthday? Who is this? Was this a birthday party? Was I supposed to bring, you know, don't even know where they are or what they should be doing. Okay, so those are the three types. Of course, they can be transformed. The greedy type becomes the connoisseur of beauty and creates beauty and shares it with others. And the aversive type develops into someone who has discriminating wisdom. That is, they see things, but they don't see faults where they aren't. They see the positive and they see the negative, but both are true to what's happening and not just created. And the confused type apparently becomes very compassionate and very understanding of other confused types and helpful. And I think that's how it works anyway. Okay. So this, the word for these proliferating thoughts is called papancha. And don't ask me how to spell it. I don't know. So working with emotions, it's important then to work with the concrete, what comes in through the body, how they manifest in the body, accepting the emotions that as they arise with interest, exploring them, not embellishing, and simply treating them like all other phenomena. They will arise. They will manifest themselves and then they will pass away. And I think that's one of the most important things in working with emotions is to know that even though they're strong and even though you might have a story around them, they do not have to be acted on in order for them to be soothed or calmed. They just have to be let alone. In other words, don't identify with them. They're not yours. They're just something. Manifestation of energy that will arise and pass away all on their own. And so you can see the psychology, the modern day psychology as well as the Buddhist psychology on there. Don't act when the emotion is strong because the mind does not see clearly, does not see the truth of things. You wait until it has passed and then you can see clearly and then you can act appropriately. And in case you've ever done this, if you've done something in the heat of anger, for example, or in the heat of desire and made a decision, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not been a very good one. So it's not necessary to dig around and try to understand it, but just try to experience it and allow it to run its course. Try not to judge yourself. I think it was Deepama who said, "Don't be bothered by your thoughts." She says, "The mind is nothing but thoughts. The mind is nothing but thoughts. Don't be bothered by them. It's all stories." So the question is basically how you're relating to the emotion that's arisen. How do you relate to it? Do you cling to it? Do you embellish it? Or can you just sit back and observe it and be curious about it and watch its life as it arises and manifests and passes away? Now, if you're sitting or if you're in your daily life and an emotion is strong. It is important to open to it, recognize it. Sometimes, especially if you have a chance just to take a deep breath and get back in touch with something that's very simple, that's physical and very simple, just to take a deep breath. Just bring yourself to that simple movement, especially if you're sitting and you can't sort of walk around and shake it off. But to sit, strong emotion comes up, just allow yourself to breathe into it, to look at it, experience it, experience the simple movement of the breath, and continue to stay with the simplest way of containing, of allowing it to manifest without feeding it with a torrent of thoughts. If you have repetitive thoughts, I believe I alluded to this last night, if you have repetitive thoughts or repetitive thought patterns, be curious about what was happening just before that thought came. And raise a question, if you can't feel anything in the body, still raise the question each time an emotion arises and there's nothing going on in the body. Continue to ask the question every time that happens, and eventually when the organism is ready, it will reveal itself. Now, one of the things that came to me as I was preparing this thought yesterday, this talk yesterday, and thinking more about it myself, I recognize that one of the things I wanted to emphasize was that we should have a lot of confidence in our own, we should have more a lot of confidence in our own ability to work with our thoughts and to experience our emotions and to act in skillful ways. And we all have a very, very deep wisdom, and I didn't quite know how I wanted to put this out, and then I remembered a story that I had read. One of the stories from Rachel Naomi Raymond's book, and I would just like to just tell you that story as an illustration of the power of our own internal knowledge. This is a story about a young man who was referred to her because he was in an imagery training program because he had cancer. And he was having, he had quite a serious diagnosis, some malignant melanoma, but he'd really been so poorly motivated to do this imagery program that they decided he needed some other kind of support. And so he just couldn't remember to do it. He was an air traffic controller, and he was reserved and quiet, and he really wanted to get well. He didn't understand why he couldn't remember to do this imagery every day. And he was truly puzzled because he was so competent in his work and he cared about getting well. So she asked him, Dr. Raymond, and Rachel Naomi Raymond, asked him about his imagery. And he, to answer her, he unfolded this a paper, and it was the drawing of a shark. And it was a traditional image that's used in some of these imagery programs. And he said he found it boring. The thousands of he was supposed to imagine thousands of tiny sharks attacking the cancer cells, and he just couldn't imagine them hunting through his body. Thought it was boring. So when he was speaking to the instructor said that he didn't think it was the right sort of image. Or he was told he had another image that he came up with, but was told it wasn't the right kind. And so Dr. Raymond asked him what his first image had been, and he said it was the problem was it wasn't vicious enough. That was what he was told. And she said, well, what was it? And he said, well, it was a catfish. And she was intrigued because she didn't know anything about catfish. She'd never even seen one. But he got very enthused when he started describing this image that he had. And he said, what catfish do in an aquarium is that they're not like other, aggressive and competitive fish, but they're bottom feeders. And this is how he described them. They said they sift the sand through their gills, evaluating constantly and sorting waste from what is not waste and eating what no longer supports the life of the aquarium. And they never sleep. They're able to make many rapid and accurate decisions. And she thought, as an air traffic controller, he admired their ability to do all of this. So she could understand that. And so she asked him to give her three words that would describe a catfish. And he said, discerning, vigilant, impeccable, thorough, steadfast, and trustworthy. So they talked a little while about the immune system. And she started to tell him at that time about what they were finding out about the immune system and DNA. And she said, our immune cells can recognize our own DNA logo and will consume any cell that doesn't carry it. And it's the defender of our identity on the cellular level. And it patrols the self and the not-self boundary, constantly discerning what is self and what is the other, never sleeping. And cancer cells have lost their DNA logo, and a healthy immune system attacks them and destroys them. And in fact, his unconscious mind had offered him a particularly accurate image of the immune system. So apparently in this research, they tried to outwit the immune system, but they couldn't. They found that no matter what situation they put the cells in, they constantly destroyed the cells that shouldn't be there. So he seemed a bit doubtful about that. And the teacher that was trying to teach him to get something that was vicious said he had to have an aggressive fighting spirit and a killer motivation to be effective in cancer-fighting imagery. And after he said that, he looked a little bit sort of uncomfortable, and she said, is there something else I should know? And he said, yeah. He said when catfish grew big where he'd been raised, that catfish did grow big where he'd been raised, and they actually, at certain times of the year, would walk across the road. You know, I've heard about this myself. Anyway, and when he was a child, it had struck him that was a sort of a miracle. And he never got tired of watching them, and in fact, he got a couple of them as pets. And so she asked him, what is a pet? And he looked surprised, and he said, why, a pet is something that loves you no matter what. And so I asked him to summarize his own imagery. And so closing his eyes, he spoke of millions of catfish that never slept, moving through his body, vigilant, untiring, dedicated, and discriminating, patiently examining every cell, passing by the ones that were healthy and eating the ones that were cancerous, motivated by a pet's unconditional love and devotion. They cared whether he lived or died. He was as special and unique to them as he was to his dog. And he opened his eyes and said, this may sound silly, but I feel sort of grateful to them for their care. And the imagery touched him deeply, and it was not hard for him to remember it, nor was it boring. And he did his meditation daily for a year. And years later, after a full recovery, he continues his practice a few times a week. He says it reminds him that, on the deepest level, his body is on his side. So I just tell that story because I feel very inspired by it. And it increases my faith in my own body and also in my own ability as a human being to understand what's good for me, what's skillful, what's appropriate, and so on. And I feel, and this is what I share with you, that what I've learned from this practice is that all of those things that I've just said have been strengthened and cultivated and have grown through the practice and through being guided by my teachers to really understand and trust and have confidence in myself as a human, to have the ability to know what's best for me and to heal myself. So I offer that because I think that those are the kinds of thoughts that are important for us to have, that the truth of that for each one of us, that we should have confidence in our capacity to heal ourselves in every way. And that you brought yourself here for your own spiritual healing and growth, I think, is testament to that, to all of you here. Just sit for a moment. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. And with our thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with an impure mind, and trouble will follow you as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. And with our thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. How can a troubled mind understand the way? Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own thoughts, unguarded. But once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father or your mother. You have about 25 minutes for walking.